the nuclear crisis and from Fermi to Fukushima and the end of the nuclear age. I'm going to turn this over to Dave Kraft, who's the head of the Nuclear Energy Information Service. He's spoken several times at this church over the years, and he'll introduce Arnie Gunderson.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for being here today. I'll keep it short because I know we have a limited amount of time here. Nuclear Energy Information Service is based in Chicago. We're a 36-year-old anti-nuclear safe energy organization, and we're dedicated to not just replacing nuclear power, but putting in renewable energy, energy efficiency, to make it work. And yesterday at 3:25 in the afternoon, the world observed the changing of the guard. It was the 75th anniversary of the first chain reaction at the University of Chicago. We knew that the nuclear industry would be celebrating this with all kinds of hoopla and, you know, half-lives and fissions and stuff. So we decided that we needed to have an alternative voice regarding nuclear power. Because as we all know, the nuclear age hasn't been kind to everybody. Just ask the Japanese if you have any doubts about that. So we decided to bring in speakers and do presentations this week, which provide a balance to what the nuclear age is all about. One of the big topics of the day is whether nuclear power can actually have any meaningful effect on reversing climate change and climate disruption. Our position is adamantly no, and we invite you to take some of the literature that we brought today that will provide at least a reasonable case against nuclear being used. But even better than that, you are in for a treat today. You have Arnie Gunderson here from Fairwinds Energy Education Corp of Vermont. Arnie is a nuclear engineer, a former nuclear utility vice president, and a whistleblower. The guy's been around the block. He's been in the industry. He's seen it from both sides, and I think you're going to get a very interesting representation of what nuclear can and can't do today. So let's get going. Arnie Gunderson.
If you're taking notes, it's Gunderson, S-E-N, and I work for Fairwinds, and there's an E in the middle of that, too. It's the old English, F-A-I-R-E, Winds. Thank you for coming today. I wanted to talk about Goldilocks and the Three Bears. I thought I'd start there. We all know the story where the porridge was, one was too hot, one was too cold, and one was just right. Well, in astronomy, there's a term called the Goldilocks zone, which around a star, there's a place that's neither too hot, like Mercury, it's a little bit too hot there, or too cold, like Mars and Jupiter and Saturn. And the Earth and Venus happen to be in that Goldilocks zone, where it's there's enough heat to have water in liquid form. Now, Venus is the you'll see it sometimes early in the morning or at sunset or sunrise, is a very bright star. In fact, it's a planet. And it's our closest neighbor. It's about 65 million miles from the sun. And the Earth is 93 million miles from the sun. But that zone, water should exist in liquid form. Anybody know how hot it is on Venus?
600 degrees.
It's like 900 degrees, right? So why is Venus in the, quote, Goldilocks zone, where liquid water should exist, why is it 900 degrees? Because its atmosphere has loaded with carbon dioxide. So when anybody says that CO2 doesn't cause global warming, just ask the people that used to live on Venus. You know? If you do the math, if Venus had an atmosphere like Earth, it would be about 165 degrees. So it would be hot, there's no doubt about it, but liquid water could exist. So in order for life to exist, you need liquid water. So now let's go to the third rock from the sun, that's us. Imagine the Earth is an apple. Well, the part that we live in, the biosphere, the habitable part of that apple is as thick as the skin on the apple. That's it. The rest of the planet is uninhabitable. So, you know, essentially the atmosphere up to 40,000 feet, geese have been known to fly over the Himalayas. So in theory, things can exist up at about 40,000 feet, down to the bottom of a trench in the Pacific, and that could be about 8 miles deep. So 8 miles high to 8 miles deep is essentially as thick as the skin on the apple. So What's happened over the years is the Earth was warmer than it is now back when the dinosaurs roamed the Earth. And not only were there dinosaurs, but there was a lot of plants. And our air has always contained carbon dioxide. And for the last millennia, many millennia, the concentration of carbon dioxide has been about 280 parts per million. That's the steady state carbon dioxide, essentially since the dinosaurs died. It's been around 280 parts per million. What part per million is, if I've got a million air molecules, 280 of them are going to be carbon dioxide. That's been the steady state number for years and for decades and centuries and eons, since the dinosaurs died. But before that, we had higher concentrations of carbon, and we had an awful lot of plants. We all know we exhale carbon dioxide, and plants absorb carbon dioxide. So all these plants absorbed that carbon dioxide, died, and then through geological processes over time, that carbon got taken out of the skin of the apple and brought down below that. So that carbon was removed from the part of the planet that we have an influence on. So about 200 years ago, with the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, mankind discovered, hey, we can burn coal to run steam engines or heat our homes. And we began to dig down below that skin of the apple and pull up some of that old carbon. And ever since then, carbon dioxide has been growing in the atmosphere. From 280 to when I was born, about 300 parts per million. So there was a very gradual, over 200 years, carbon dioxide did go up. How do people know that? They know it because of ice cores. They drill down into glaciers and they, the Greenland ice pack or whatever, and they can sample what the atmosphere was like at different points in time, back thousands and thousands of years. And with the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, when mankind was able to puncture the skin of the apple and get below it, get to all these dead dinosaurs and all the dead plants that had turned to coal and oil and natural gas, now we started to bring that carbon up to the surface again. So when we started to burn fossil fuels, essentially at the Industrial Revolution, 1700 roughly, carbon dioxide began gradually to increase. So with that as an introduction, let's go to when I was born. And somebody really smart in Hawaii in the 1960s at a place called Mauna Loa began to measure the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere every year. And so when you hear the Mauna Loa data, it goes back to 1960, and somebody has been continuously tracking carbon dioxide in the atmosphere since then. So we were running along for thousands and thousands of years at 280, and then it started to gradually go up, and when I was born, it was 300 to 310, roughly. And then it began to increase, and the one slide I'll be using today is the one that's up there. On the left is it's a red spiky slide, and it shows the Mauna Loa data, and no one is disputing this Mauna Loa data. It's scientifically proven. Now you'll see it goes up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down, but the trend of the line is always up, and what's happening there is every summer carbon dioxide drops because plants absorb carbon from the atmosphere. And every winter, carbon dioxide goes up. But the trend of the line is upward because mankind is throwing more carbon into the atmosphere every year. So that's the Mauna Loa data. Now, what happened, you've heard of Bill McKibben and 350.org? He gets his 350 from the concentration in the atmosphere of 350 parts per million. And a lot of scientists say that's the red line. Now that we're over 350, the climate will change. And we're not just over it by a little bit. We're now over it by 50 parts per million. We're up at over 400 parts per million in carbon. So remember now, with the advent of the Industrial Revolution, we're at 280, and 310 by the time I was born. So just barely, 10% went up a little bit. And now since 1960, it's screamed upward from 310 to 400. McKibben chose 350. It's right around the same time that James Hansen said that carbon dioxide is a real problem and it's going to affect the climate. So McKibben's goal in 350.org is to turn the curve around, to turn the Mauna Loa data around and get it to go back down. And the world that we're used to, the world where you can go skiing in the winter and mountains actually have snow on them and things like that, only exists if the CO2 levels can stabilize at 350. So lesson number one is we're in trouble. That's what the Mauna Loa data shows. The curve next to it is something that Fairwinds put together. We had four interns and two PhDs working for a year to get that the curve on the right there. Then I need to introduce another term. And I promise there will only be two terms: parts per million and gigatons. You know, when you've got your computer has megabytes and then gigabytes and then terabytes. Giga is a term, and it means a million, a thousand million is a giga. So when we talk about gigatons, we talk about a thousand million tons. In America, I could say billion, but the Brits and the Japanese have different terms for it. So the scientific community says giga to confuse people and make us think that they're smarter than we are. But so anyway, mankind's throwing up a lot of dead dinosaurs into the atmosphere every year. And we're throwing up, as right now, about 36 gigatons per year, 36,000 million tons, 36 billion tons of carbon dioxide every year. That's a big number. And it's roughly the equivalent of the amount of dead dinosaurs that died in a million years. So every year, we're sucking out a million years worth of carbon dioxide that's been stored below the skin of the apple and throwing that back into the atmosphere. So there's a definite correlation here. They're both going up. Parts per million are going up at about 2 parts per million a year. And mankind's been throwing carbon into the atmosphere at a little less than an extra gigaton a year for the last, essentially since I've been in the nuclear industry. So there's a definite correlation. The more CO2 we throw up, the more we become like Venus, and the less we become like the Earth that we knew about. So let's just keep that up there, keep it in mind, and now I'll talk about nuclear power and its relationship to global warming. I got out of college in 71 with a bachelor's and 72 with my master's in nuclear engineering. And that was at the beginning of there were very few nuclear plants when I started college, and 20 years later, there's 450 of them. So it was the first boom in nuclear power. Since about 1990, there haven't been many more because of economics. And actually, Forbes magazine said that building those 450 nuclear power plants was, and this is their words, the biggest managerial disaster in the history of business. And that was in 1985. Now, Forbes is not an anti-nuke outfit. I mean, they have no dog in the fight. They're business. And so America's commitment to build over 100 nukes and the world's commitment to build 450 nukes was the biggest managerial disaster in the history of business, according to Forbes magazine. So now let's get to Illinois. Illinois has the most nukes of any state in the union. And of course, you're aware that there's been a big bailout of the nuclear plants in Illinois. I can assure you, I built these plants. I worked at Dresden down the road here by about 50 miles. I worked up at Zion. I worked at Quad Cities and Braidwood during my career. But when those plants were built, nobody built them about carbon dioxide. carbon dioxide wasn't even on the radar back in the 70s when these plants were built. So now the nuclear industry is saying, whoa, we need these nukes because of carbon dioxide. That's a marketing ploy. But they were not built because of that. You might remember in the 70s we had these gas lines and things like that. They were built because there was an energy shortage. We were running out of energy. We needed nuclear power to displace oil. That didn't happen. But in fact, those nukes, carbon dioxide was never on the agenda. Right around the year 2000, as these old nukes were aging and becoming more expensive to run, they latched on to the marketing ploy, oh my God, nukes are going to save the world from carbon dioxide buildup. So I want to set aside the desecration of Native American lands from mining, forget about the desecration of Fukushima and Chernobyl from disasters, and let's not worry about storing nuclear waste for 250,000 years. Let's set all that aside, and we'll just talk about money. Okay, so this is the next little bit here is about money. The nuclear plants that are out there now do displace some carbon dioxide. And so 450 nuclear plants, let's look at the gigatons. 36 gigatons is what we are throwing up into the world through our cars, through heating, through everything, every year. Now, if we didn't have those 450 nukes, this is an audience participation piece here. If we didn't have those 450 nukes, how much more gigatons do you think we would throw up? And I'll give you the bands: 5%, 10%, 20%, and 50% more gigatons of carbon dioxide going up into the atmosphere. So, show of hands. So, who thinks if we didn't have those 450 nukes, if they had never been built, how much worse would it be? 5%. Okay, about half the group. 10%? Oh, about the other half of the group. 20%? And 50%. Okay, so the group is saying 5 to 10% seems to be the consensus here. Well, at Fairwinds, what we did was we used nuclear industry data from one of their international websites, and the real answer is, if we didn't have all those nukes, there would be 1 gigaton more for all of them. 1 gigaton more would be thrown into the atmosphere, or 3%. So the group that said 5%, that was the right answer. Nukes are only eliminating 3% of the carbon dioxide that's getting thrown into the atmosphere now. And that's all of them. That's all 450 of them. So
worldwide,
450 worldwide nukes. And in the U.S., we've got 100. In Illinois, I think you've got 18. Is that right?
11 operating,
okay. So then what you do is you take 3% and you divide it by 450, and each nuclear power plant is reducing global gases into the atmosphere, carbon dioxide, by 0.007%, 0.007%. So when you hear that argument that, oh my God, if we shut down Quad Cities, all the polar bears are going to die, it's just not true. It's an inconsequential amount. Millie, we talk about nuclear taking a bite out of climate change. Nuclear is taking a nibble out of climate change. So when we look at where we are now, nuclear hasn't bent the curve. And in fact, if you talk to climate scientists, they say if we had spent all that money in that, quote, managerial disaster on renewables, we would be much better off than with the 450 nukes that we have today. So that's where we are today. We're throwing up 36 gigatons, and without nukes, we'd be throwing up 37 gigatons. 3% more. And the question is, did we spend the money correctly back in the 80s and 70s? Could it have been better spent? It's spent. We can't worry about it. It's water under the bridge. Now let's look forward into 2050. So 35 years out, roughly. And the nuclear industry has said that in order to combat global warming, we need 1,000 new nuclear plants. 1,000 new nuclear plants. So, and they never say that the other part of that is that it's going to take us 35 years to build them, and it's going to cost $8.2 trillion to build them. Now, and that number, the $8.2 trillion, comes from the investment banking firm Lazard. Now, so they don't have a dog in this fight either. It's not like I'm relying on Greenpeace or Friends of the Earth or any, quote, anti-nuclear organization. This is banks and the nuclear industry that the information I'm sharing it with. So the nuclear industry says that they need 1,000 new nukes, and they don't say the other half of that. And, oh, by the way, it's going to cost $8.2 trillion to build. So the question is this thing in economics called the opportunity cost. And the question is, if you spend 8.2 on nukes, 8.2 trillion, could that money have been better spent on something else? This is a discussion the United States should have had back in 1970 or 1960 during that first boom, but we didn't. And so we have 450 nukes that we are essentially living with. But do we have to double down on that bet and add 1,000 more? First off, 1,000 new nukes means that a new nuclear plant would have to go online just about every 10 or 12 days between now and 2050. And there is no infrastructure to do that. You know, the colleges that used to teach nuclear engineering aren't anymore. The facilities that are capable of building a nuclear reactor or turbines or all of the nuclear components aren't capable of building one every 12 days. The engineering schools just are not there, and the engineering talent is not there to build that many power plants in that time span. So there's an infrastructure issue that how could we ever do that anyway? But hey, when there's $8.2 trillion on the line, I'm sure somebody will figure out a way to make that happen. So MIT has done a study. And MIT actually has a Tokyo Electric chair in their nuclear department. So again, they're certainly not anti-nuclear. And MIT says that these gigatons of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere are going to grow to about 60 gigatons per year, even if the United States and other nations implement the Paris Accords. You know, the Paris Accords are the thing that the Trump administration is trying to get us out of. Even if we were in that game and everybody else was in that game, the CO2 would still increase to about 60 gigatons over the next 35 years. So why is that? The answer is everybody wants to live like us. You know, the people in India want their car and their air conditioning. The people in China want their car and their air conditioning. South Asia wants a car and air conditioning. Africa wants their car and air conditioning. South America wants their car and air conditioning. And you can't begrudge people for wanting to live like we do. So if that trend were to continue, we would be at 60 gigatons per year, even if the best efforts of COP 21, the Paris Accords, took effect. So if, and the MIT, those MIT numbers assume 1,000 new nukes are built. So the key here is that it takes 35 years to build them. And there's this concept, in addition to opportunity cost, the fact of the matter is that global climate change isn't going to say, well, we'll take a vacation for 35 years while you build those nukes. It's still growing. And if you the midpoint of 35 years is 17 years, at 2 parts per million a year, global warming is going to increase by 32 parts per million while we're building those nukes. So what percent of that 60 gigatons will these new nukes take a bite out of? And the answer is 6%. So the nuclear industry would like to have us spend $8 trillion to solve 6% of the problem. And oh, by the way, we're going to take 35 years to solve it. and to my way of thinking, and to an awful lot of people's way of thinking, that doesn't make economic sense. You know, forget the indigenous lands, forget the odds are there'll be a meltdown like Chernobyl or Fukushima, about 50-50 odds in the next 10 years. Push all that stuff aside and just talk about the money. Does it make sense to invest $8.2 trillion to solve 6% of the problem? Now, this opportunity cost number that economists use is, I think, is a critical concept here. And that's basically, if I commit to spend $8.2 trillion on nuclear, that's $8.2 trillion I can't spend on renewables or energy conservation or any of those alternatives. Well, it turns out that, let's get back to money now. We're putting aside all the insults to the environment. Get back to money. A new nuke, electricity is measured at something called bus bar cost. And as it leaves the power plant, for an existing nuke, it's about 6 or 8 cents to create the kilowatt of electricity that leaves the power plant. Now, you pay more than that. Your bill is higher than 8 cents a kilowatt. And that's because after it leaves the power plant, there's distribution and transmission costs to get it to you. But the cost of the power plant is 6 to 8 cents for a power plant today. These new nukes are now so expensive that the bus bar cost, the cost as it leaves the boundary and heads out into the grid, is going to be about 20 cents a kilowatt compared to 2 cents right now for solar. So a new nuke is 10 times more expensive than an electric watt generated by solar. Now people will say, well, yeah, but solar's intermittent. So let's go to Elon Musk and throw one of his batteries on. And solar plus one of Musk's batteries is around 6 or 8 cents, and that number's declining. So a grid of distributed power, thousands of solar collectors or windmills or whatever, linked together with a storage system, is at least half as cheap as a nuclear baseload alternative. So I think what's going to happen here is that 100 years from now, when a historian looks back on what we're going through right now, they're going to say that this is not about being pro-nuke or anti-nuke. It's really not. It's a change in the paradigm. When I was building nukes, we had to build central powers because we didn't have the technology that has developed for solar collectors, and we didn't have the ability with computers to connect small distributed loads. We needed a big power plant, and for Illinois, there's probably a couple hundred, including the nukes, to do that. But times have changed. You know, just like we don't have to be connected into a central phone system anymore, the computers have replaced that. Or just like my computer doesn't need, I don't need to go to a mainframe to do a calculation anymore. I can do that. What's happened is that the grid is changing from a central station paradigm in the 20th century to a 21st century paradigm of a distributed network. And the battle that we're in, I think when you look back 100 years from now, will not be about, I was an anti-nuke or I was a pro-nuke. The battle is, the world is changing, and the central station people, including the people we heard at the University of Chicago and the need for nuclear, those people are trapped in a 20th century paradigm. But the 21st century paradigm is going to be one of thousands of interconnected small collectors that, in fact, talk to each other. Now, that exists right now. Denmark has changed from a system of about 20 or 30 or 40 large power plants to a system of hundreds of windmills and solar and garbage burners. Denmark actually is importing garbage from Germany to run their trash plants instead of relying on coal or oil. Now, I should mention one other thing about biomass. You know, we talk about burning coal. Now, that's going underneath that layer of the apple and pulling up old carbon and throwing it up in the air. when you burn wood, and in Burlington, Vermont, where I'm from, we have a wood-burning power plant, it produces carbon, but that carbon was already in the skin of the apple. So it burning biomass, whatever it is, wood or grass or whatever, burning biomass doesn't change the total amount of carbon in the skin of the apple. What it does do is produce power, and there's no increase in carbon dioxide. It's only when we drill through the skin of the apple and suck up that carbon, or in oil or gas, or when we dig it up with coal, that we take carbon that's below the skin of the apple and pull it up into the atmosphere. So one of the things that's happened in the last 3 years is that the curve on the right has flattened out. We have been going up at a little less than a gigaton a year, but for the last 2 years, it's flattened out. And that's a fascinating trend. What's happened there is that China is building more renewables and shutting down their coal plants. So China has cut back on the amount of carbon dioxide that it's throwing up in the atmosphere. So the curve has leveled out as far as gigatons getting thrown in the atmosphere. But guess what? The PPMs are still going up. The carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, even though we're not adding any more carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, we still are adding 36 new gigatons every year, and the PPMs are still going up at roughly 2 ppm per year. Now, that's frightening, and what that says is that the ability of the Earth to absorb that carbon dioxide is maxed out. The Earth can't absorb anymore into the oceans or into the rainforests or wherever that carbon dioxide has been going. So we need to come up with technologies that are cheap, certainly cheaper than nuclear, and fast. I can build the equivalent of 50 power plants using solar in the time it takes to build one nuclear. And for roughly the same price. You know, and so that's the key. We need to, the climate change is a now problem. And to talk about, well, maybe we should develop fusion power, and that's going to be 50 years from now before we get the first one, or traveling wave, or Bill Gates says that small modulars are the way to go. All of those are solutions that of which the first power plant may come online 20 years from now. 20 years is too late for the first one. We need a system, a distributed system, that solves the problem right now. And it, luckily for us, it's available. It wasn't available when I was building power plants, but it is now, and that's a distributed system, and it's cheaper, and it's faster, and it works. So thank you very much, and I'll take questions, and we'll go from there.
Okay, we only have about 10 minutes.
Say something about this program yesterday at the University of Chicago. Were there a number of people that were for nuclear, and did they all hear what you had to say?
The University of Chicago program was an infomercial for the nuclear industry. The speakers on the stage were all pro-nuclear, and you know, when you have Secretary Moniz up there from MIT, he's going to be supporting nuclear power. And the economist they had there, although he pretended to be neutral, just follow the money, in fact, he did not. The question and answer periods were not adequate to approach that. So the celebration, I thought it was going to be a commemoration of nuclear, but in fact, it became a celebration. And it was, to my mind, it was lopsided. It didn't take into account the environmental effects, you know, the destruction of Native American lands, the fact that these nuclear plants are always put in areas where the economy has collapsed and essentially low income and ethnically a lot less white than the crowd that was at the University of Chicago.
Did you all hear your presentation?
No, I didn't speak at University of Chicago. I spoke at DePaul yesterday, and that was a separate. That was a separate thing. They didn't want me at University of Chicago.
I didn't hear you mention anything about geothermal.
Yeah, that's important. A renewable source is geothermal, and the the country that uses geothermal is Iceland. You know, they're essentially, but also there's some geothermal plants in California as well. You know what I think is going to happen is that we will be using more electricity over time, but we will be in our cars and heating our houses and things like that. So if you're investing in utilities that get it, that get the fact that they need a distributed network, is probably the wave of the future. But I think instead of burning natural gas and instead of burning oil to heat our homes and to heat our businesses, we'll be using geothermal heat pumps. And which is essentially we'll be transferring the hot air in a building to the cold air outside and opposite in the winter. We'll have electric cars and we'll have geothermal heat pumps. So the grid will become, the electric utility system will become more important, but it just won't be driven by baseload power. The geothermal sources are kind of limited. There's none in Illinois, but they're, you know, where they are, California, up the West Coast, kind of Ring of Fire, and also in Iceland. Those areas, it'll be important locally, but the national system, I think, will be more on, driven more by renewables like wind and solar, and energy efficiency. Energy efficiency is still as cheap as building a solar collector. If you want to put Exelon out of business, put one solar collector on your roof. And what that does is that the power, they make their money at the peak. And the peak, of course, occurs when the sun is really bright and really hot. Well, if you're generating your maximum capacity at the peak, you're reducing their profits. So every one of us, if we put one solar collector on our roof, would take a nibble out of Exelon's profits and force them to shut the nukes down quicker.
I know you have been studying the Fukushima reactor incidents. So what can we learn from Fukushima, and what does it take to get the word out for the press here?
I'll answer. I had another thought right before that, but I will answer your question. If you go up on the Fairwinds site, F-A-I-R-E Winds, and type in smokescreen, we have a two-minute animation. We've consolidated all these speeches and 70 pages of PowerPoints from Amory Lovins and 70 pages of PowerPoints from Michael Schneider, and we've collapsed it down into a two-minute animation. Then if you click on smokescreen, you can get this whole thing into 2 minutes. So to answer your question, though, on the money issue, that to clean up Fukushima Daiichi is going to cost about $500 billion, $500 billion. And the quote savings from nuclear power in Japan doesn't even approach that. So, you know, you have a technology that one bad day can wipe out the financial gains of decades. And now here in the United States, we have Price Anderson, which means that when a nuke collapses, Exelon will continue, and you and I will foot the bill. In Japan, Tokyo Electric has actually been driven into receivership, which is more stringent than the requirements in the U.S. So from a financial standpoint, spending $500 billion to clean up a mess means that the billions that you saved by not importing oil just went down the drain. I could go on about Fukushima, about the cleanup of Fukushima forever, but they've cleaned up 5% of the prefecture. A prefecture's like a state. Fukushima prefecture is as big as Connecticut, and they've cleaned up where the people live, and they clean up about 30 feet, 10 meters on either side of all the highways. And they leave the rest of it up there in the woods. And even that minimal cleanup of about 5% of the land area has generated 30 million tons of radioactive waste. You've seen those black bags, probably. A bag is 3 feet by 3 feet by 3 feet, and it weighs a ton. There's 30 million bags of waste, and they've only cleaned up 5% of the prefecture. What I found, I've been over there 4 times, and the last 2 trips have been eye-openers. What's happening is the areas that are clean are becoming recontaminated. That makes sense. I mean, if it's dirty over here and clean here, where does the dirt go? It moves right back in. And so they are recontaminating, and I think it's a the travesty here is the inhumanity of the Japanese government to its own people.
The stats that you could build 50 solar plants for every nuclear, can you translate that into how much carbon would that replace? In other words, we're spending all this money on nuclear. If we put that money towards carbon replacement, my guess is it would do more than the nuclear.
Oh, it would,
50
yes.
50 to 1.
Yeah, 50 to 1. Yeah.
But 50 carbon replacements to 1 or just 50 plants to 1?
50 carbon replacements to 1, yeah. You know, in nuclear economics, the theory has always been nuclear plants cost a lot of money, but the fuel is relatively cheap. Well, the last time I checked, sunlight was really cheap. You know, so the nuclear, it costs less to build the solar, and, oh, by the way, the fuel is absolutely free, and that's what's really distorting the economics in favor of solar. I had a quote. This whole speech came because of my last trip out here with NEIS, and I gave a speech at Northwestern. And the quote that got carried around the world was, the nuclear industry would have you believe that they are so smart that they can hold nuclear waste, they can store nuclear waste for 250,000 years. But the rest of us are so dumb we can't figure out a way to store solar electricity overnight. And that just doesn't make sense.
Their argument for continuation and expansion of nuclear energy is to save us from the existential threat of increasing climate instability. Can you speak to the fragileness of nuclear technology and what an increasingly unstable climate might do to availability of water, disruption of the external power systems, etc. And in the event that that happens, the loss of control of the radioactive materials, either in the reactor or the holding ponds where they exist.
Yeah, Crane, 2 days ago, the head of Exelon, a guy named Crane, was speaking, and he basically said, you know, nuclear is a big boy toy, and it's the base load, the 20th century paradigm of base load. He can't see changing in the 21st century. But in fact, you know, the argument is the opposite of what the nuclear industry would have you believe. They're saying nukes will make the world safe for global warming, but we actually have to decrease global warming to make the world safe for nukes. And because nuclear power uses an enormous amount of water compared to any other power source, it's terribly inefficient. It's something called Carnot efficiency. It has the lowest Carnot efficiency of anything in the last 100 years. It's a terribly inefficient way of boiling water. So what's happening now in France, and it actually happened in Connecticut and down in Florida, as the waters warm up, they're having to shut down nuclear power plants. So the potential solution to climate change, nuclear power, is in fact, as climate is changing, that the oceans of the world are becoming too hot, and they can't cool these nukes fast enough. Dresden happened here, it happened at TVA in Tennessee, where the cooling water got so hot that they had to shut the nuclear plants down. To me, that's not reliability. And in fact, large central station power plants don't play well in a grid that has distributed. So we are at a cusp now of do we want to go back to the 20th century, you know, make America great again back in the 20th century, or do we want a 21st century paradigm that's dramatically different?
I think we should thank Mr. Gunderson. Thank you.